We have, this week we have Parsha Shoftim, which is the Parsha dealing with the appointment of judges. And essentially what's very interesting is that Moshe Rabbeinu in the Midbar is really like what you might call a one-man show. He's both the political leader, he is the religious leader, he is the prophet. But the Jewish people are about to enter the land of Israel, and in Eretz Israel there's not going to be a Moshe Rabbeinu. And as a result, there is going to be a need for what is called role differentiation. Different people are going to be taking different roles, all of which were unified in the persona of Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Ramban writes in the Hakdama to Sefer Devarim, the Sefer Devarim goes by the name Mishneh Torah, which literally means a repetition of the Torah, but that's only partially true. Some of Sefer Devarim is repeating, but some of it is new, a lot of it is new. And the Ramban says the criterion of what enters the Book of Devarim and what doesn't is special information that they need to know in the land of Israel. And this division of authority is very Nogea Eretz Israel, because in the Midbar there really was not that much of a division of authority. And thus, if you look at it, this atomization of authority occurs on many levels. We have judges who are in charge of resolving disputes between people. We have the Sanhedrin, the ultimate Supreme Court, which is involved in the interpretation of the Torah. That's both legislating and interpreting. We have the Navi, who is involved in spiritual leadership. And we have the Melech, who is involved in political leadership, right? So Melech, the king, is the political leader. The Navi, the prophet, is the spiritual leader, but that's not the same as the halachic leader. Be sure you understand the difference. A Navi cannot tell you what the halacha is. A Navi cannot tell you, this is how you do a mitzvah. In point of fact, the Gemara says, if I come, even if I'm a Navi, and I do miracles, and I prove to you that the halacha is a certain way, you don't listen to me, because the Torah says, lo b'shamayim, it is not in heaven. So we'll call the Navi the spiritual leader. But we'll have to, I don't want to compare this much, but like the role of a Hasidic Rebbe versus a Poser. A Hasidic Rebbe doesn't paskin shilas. But a Hasidic Rebbe has a connection to God, so it helps you in Avodas Hashem. Well, kal v'chomer, kal v'chomer, kal v'chomer. A Navi does not paskin halachic shilas, except in his capacity as a chacham. But a Navi is the one that gives us messages from Hashem. So the Navi is the spiritual leader. The Melech is the political leader. The Sanhedrin is the halachic leader, the ultimate authority. And individual judges on a lower level are there to resolve the machlokes bein adam lechaveru. So in other words, this is what you might call an atomization of authority. Moshe Rabbeinu united all of these different roles, but once they come to Eretz Israel, there needs to be a differentiation. One person cannot do it all. And in fact, this notion of separation of power is a term that might be familiar to us from the Constitution, if you've had either civics classes in high school or political science classes, or you know about the U.S. Constitution. With apologies to people who are not from the United States. Americans think there's only two countries in the world. There's only Eretz Israel and the United States. I know there's something I heard about Canada and some other places and the like. But this idea of separation of powers is in the Torah itself. For example, let me give you an example. On one hand, the Navi, who is so connected to Hashem, cannot paskin halacha. A Navi cannot tell you what the halacha is because of the din of lo b'shamayim. We don't listen to heavenly voices. We don't listen to divine inspiration. We'll talk about why that's so. So that's one level of separation. We separate the charismatic spiritual leader from the halachic scholar. He has to be an objective poseik using only the tools of precedent and reason, not divine inspiration. Okay, no poseik can say, the halacha is like me because Hashem told me so. That is not legitimate. That is not accepted. Ein mashgichim bebaskol, we don't resolve halacha by a baskol. So that's separation of spiritual leadership from halachic leadership. But there's even a rule about separation of powers between a melech and a kohen. We know, for example, that for around almost 200 years, the Jewish people, before the destruction of the Second Temple, before the Romans came on the scene, the Jewish people briefly had their own independent state. This is the Hasmonean state. This is what we celebrate during Hanukkah. It was the overthrow of Greek oppression, and the Jewish people established their own state, which lasted for around 200 years until the Romans came in and conquered it, and then eventually the Romans destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. This is called Malchus Hashmonai. We celebrate this every year. We light Hanukkah candles, etc. And yet, the Gemara tells us that Malchus Hashmonai eventually became totally extinct. The last surviving woman, or the last surviving person of Malchus Hashmonai was a woman, and when Herod wanted to take her for his wife, she jumped off a roof, she committed suicide, and she screamed out in her last moments, "Anyone who claims descent from the royal house of the Hashmonaim is a slave," because Herod was a slave of the Hashmonaim. The Romans made him a king. So the Ramban in the Chumash, in Vayichi, raises a very interesting question. Given the fact that the Hashmonaim were very, very righteous, they were the ones who refused to give in to the Greeks, they were the ones who kept the Torah at all costs, they were the ones that galvanized the people. They were Hasidei Elyon, the Ramban says, righteous, pious people of the highest level, the highest madriga. Why, after 150, 200 years, were they totally wiped out in such a ignominious way? So the Ramban says, because although they were righteous, they did commit one great sin. They shouldn't have become kings. They should not have made themselves kings. After they achieved a military victory, they should not have assumed the Malchus. They should have looked for somebody else. Now, what's so bad about the Hashmonaim being kings? So the Ramban gives two different reasons. Reason number one is the more famous reason, and that is that on Yaakov Avinu's deathbed, when he was blessing all of his children, all of the tribes, he stated, "Lo Yasur Shevet Miyehuda," the kingship of the Jews must go to the tribe of Yehuda. That's why David HaMelech is in the tribe of Yehuda. And therefore, Malchus Hashmonai was a sinful Malchus, because they should have looked for a descendant of David HaMelech, or at least the tribe of Yehuda, and give it to them. They should not have assumed Malchus on their own. That is reason number one the Ramban gives, and that I think is the best known reason. A lot of people have heard that reason. Of course, it raises a whole bunch of questions, because after all, in the time of the Tanakh, there was a whole northern kingdom of 10 tribes, and they had a separate king. Now, granted, a lot of those kings were no good, but you don't find them being criticized because they had a kingdom. They're criticized because they did have Avodah Zarah, but the actual fact that they became kings was not in itself criticized. But the Emesis, the Ramban says, yeah, it was a sin. The kingdom of the north, the 10 tribes, should not have kept their own kingdom. They should have abdicated in favor of Malchus based up. Now that is reason number one the Ramban gives. But what's lesser known is the Ramban gives reason number two. And he brings it from the Yerushalmi, in which he says, even if we assume it is not so bad for someone other than the tribe of Yehuda to be a king, but there's a special aveira for a Kohen to be a king, and the Hashmonaim were Kohanim. In other words, the problem was not that they weren't Yehuda. Maybe if they'd be Sachar or Zebulun, Reuben or Shimon, maybe that's okay. But a Kohen to be a Melech, a Kohen and a Melech have to be totally separate. The political leader of the Jewish people cannot be a religious leader. This is really literally separation of what we call in America, separation of church, a religion, and state. But it's interesting. Here's the point. The Ramban is masber like this. If you ask a secular person, you know, why is there separation of church and state, they will tell you something like, we need to protect the government from the influences of religion. That obviously wouldn't be the Torah's philosophy. The Torah's philosophy is, in an ideal Jewish state, we want the state to be governed by the Torah. We're not going to say, oh, Chas v'Shalom, we don't want religion to impact on politics. The Ramban says the danger is the other danger. The danger is when your religious leader gets too involved in political processes, the religious leader is no longer a voice of pure spirituality. Because what happens is there's a tremendous Yetzer Hara in political activity. It is the Yetzirah of power. It is the Yetzirah of money. It is the Yetzirah of building up influence and therefore perhaps, chas v'shalom, sometimes compromising principles. I don't want to get into too specific things, but we've seen this in Israel over and over and over again, where there are people who are from and people who were B'nai Torah, you know, who got involved in taking bribes and who had to go to jail and the like. How does that happen? How does a person who spent many, many years, you know, learning in Kola, a person who's totally committed to it, a person who would never think of not having Chol of Yisrael, how did they get involved in bribery and in stealing? We can't really judge. We don't know if we would be only B'nai Sayyid. I don't want to say, but the point basically is, when you're involved in the political system, you control money, you control power, the Yetziharas are very, very great. And that is why, the Ramban says from the Yerushalmi, the Kohen has to be the Koach of Ruchnius in society. He should not be involved in day-to-day politics. Because that way, he remains pure, and he can give guidance. So the separation of powers here, or the separation of church and state, is not to protect the state from the church, church running religion, but to protect the church, the religion, from the state. That there is something about taking. And that is why, I don't want to get into this, but there is a big discussion among different thinkers, different gedolim, how involved, you know, in Israel, obviously religious people are very, very involved with politics. Because they say, well, we have yeshivas, you know, we need to be involved. We have so many people that we need to look after their interests. I mean, just like every interest group has its political involvement, why shouldn't religious Jews? But there are those, there are minority voices, granted, but there are those who say that, you know, if religion would be outside of politics, it would be more pristine, it would be more pure. And although it's not for me to be machriya, I'm obviously not going to be machriya, because obviously gedolim have felt there needs to be political development. But I do want to just say, a little bit of the devil's advocate, that I think there is a makor to that idea from the Ramban and from the Yerushalmi, that the Torah prohibits the Kohen from being the melech in order that the melech should not be, in order that the Kohen should not be compromised. It should be a spiritual voice that's not influenced by power and coalitions. Now, not that this is approved, but I do want to say that I don't have a well, the Pope agrees with the Yerushalmi. That's not a, obviously it wouldn't be too much of an authoritative riot for us, but this is not this Pope, but the preceding Pope actually issued a proclamation that no Catholic priest is allowed to have political office. So in Washington, there was a congressman, Robert Drennan, you may have heard of him over the years. He was president of Georgetown University, but then he was in Congress, and he happened to be a Catholic priest. And he was in Congress for many years. And after this gazera, he resigned his seat in the middle of the term. He left office because the Pope said, you can no longer be in politics. Right? So again, perhaps the Pope learns Yerushalmi, you know, who knows. But there would be a mocker to this. From the Talmud of Yerushalmi, the idea of separation of okay, did someone had a hand over there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, so the melas, like the Yehuda Shlomo, were, what was, am I wrong by saying this, that one of the qualifications, so to speak, was that they had to be in tzaddikim, they had to be...
Oh, no, of course, let me make that point. I'm not saying a melech shouldn't be righteous. Of course, a melech should be righteous. Some of our kings were not, but David certainly was righteous. But what I'm saying is that the person whose role in society is to be the halachic and spiritual leader has to be outside of the political process to give the king mussar and tokacha and guidance. Because if your Rosh Hashiva, let's say, is also your president, there is a fear that the Rosh Hashiva might compromise some principles because he's president. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying let's get a leader that's not religious. That's not the idea. But the one that is the religious figure, the religious leader, should be outside of the process. That's what you're saying.
Because like, we still look up to the Malachs as you know, some of them as tzaddikim, even though they had to go through that political process,
which
may have corrupted them. But
it may have corrupted them, but that's exactly the point. When you have the spiritual leader outside, for example, let's take David the Malach as a very good example. Now, David was, of course, a tremendously righteous person. Mashiach will come from David. But we know that David committed the sin of David and Bathsheba, right? You know the story. Now, if you read the story literally, David seems to have committed adultery with a married woman. The Gemara tells us that we should not take the story literally in point of fact. She was divorced, and David was sleeping with an unmarried woman. But nevertheless, David then sent her husband to the front, and the husband gets killed, and then David feels he can marry her in good conscience.
Was he chayav misa?
So the Gemara says he was even chayav misa. But again, David had, okay, you have to understand. So David had perfect halachic justification for everything that he did. Right? He's with her when she's single, and the husband disobeys the royal order. And yet, we find that David is considered to have sinned, right? The prophet comes to David, because David was using halacha as a loophole to allow him to do things. Now, the story goes that Nathan was the big Navi after Shmuel. Shmuel had died already. But Nathan the prophet, comes to David, and it's a very dramatic scene, actually. And Nathan HaNavi tells David, I have a shiloh to ask you. What do you think is king? About two men, a rich man and a poor man. Maybe I'm sure you've heard this. The rich man has so many flocks of sheep, and this poor man has one little lamb that he cherishes. And the rich man makes a banquet, and he decides to take the one lamb that this poor man has and shech it and eat it. What do you think about such a guy? David HaMelech says, such a person is awful. He's a lowlife. He's degenerate. He deserves to die for his selfishness. Nathan HaNavi then says to David, you are that man. You're a king. You have everything you want in the world. And this man only had one thing in life. He had his wife. That's all he had. And you wanted her, and you took her. Now, you see what's going on here. Here you have a Navi who goes over to the most powerful man in the world, the king, right? The king. And is able to tell that king, you sinned. And that king does tshuva. Now, imagine if Nathan HaNavi was also the Secretary of State in David HaMelech's cabinet. You know, we don't know. It would be harder for Nathan the prophet to tell David, you sinned, because Nathan might lose his job. See the idea? In other words, the point basically is that by having someone like a Navi outside, or a Kohen, outside of the system, you're now able to be that spiritual voice that ensures that even when David sins, he does tshuva and becomes righteous. And you see the idea here. But just imagine, if Nathan would have had a government position, he could, now again, I assume as a Navi, he would have been great enough to even do that, but other people who were not on the level of Navi might not be. So as a result, we create this general idea, keep the spiritual people, leaders, outside of the system so they're not beholden to the system. By the way, in a similar way, although it's only by analogy, you've all heard of the Bach. Right? The Bach is an abbreviation of Bayis Chadash. This is a great rabbi, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, who wrote commentaries on the Gemara, commentaries on the Torah, etc. So he lived in the 1500s, probably way after this, and he writes that a rabbi of a community should be independently wealthy. A rabbi of a community, this doesn't always work out that way, but the rabbi of a community should not be financially dependent on his community. Same idea, because when I'm financially dependent, it's going to be hard for me to get up and give them mussar and tochacha and correct what needs to be corrected, because if they don't like me, they'll fire me. So I'll be afraid. But if I have my own parnassa, so to speak, the Bach says, I'll have more fearlessness in addressing the issues that need to be. In the real world, it doesn't always work out that way, obviously, because people don't always have their separate parnassas. But the Bach very much encouraged Rabbanim to have another source of income that didn't depend on the kehila. And then they were able to do whatever they needed to do with the kehila without fear of reprisal in any particular way. Okay? So this is the very interesting idea of separation of powers that emerges from the Chumash. So this is actually very, very fascinating that we have this division of authority. But now I want to mention one other thing. And that is, on one hand we have courts, basins, and as you know, in a Torah society, there are three levels of course, three levels of bastions. Lowest level is a basin of three judges. That simply means I'm suing you for $100. We have machlokes. I say you broke a lease, or I say you owe me money. You say I owe you money, whatever it is. Mezikin. So that goes before a court of three judges. And generally speaking, the psak is based on a majority. 2-1. Whatever the two judges decide, that becomes the halacha. There is, in the classical system, no appeal, by the way. See, there are three levels of courts, but it's not that the higher level appeals the lower level. The higher level has separate powers. In terms of the actual decision, there is no such thing in Jewish law as an appeal. The decision of a beis din is final. There is no appeal on a beis din. An interesting shaila, contemporary shaila, is this. The Rabbanut does have a system of batei din. Some people use it, some people don't, but the Rabbanut does have, and indeed, there are some of the dayanim, maybe most of them, maybe all of them even, are very, very chashuv talmidei chachamim. Rabbi Yashiv, for many years, was the head dayan of the Rabbanut's beis din. I even know Rabbi Yashiv was ideologically disagreed with Rabbanut in so many matters, but he was the head of their beis din until he resigned in protest in 1970 because it's something that the chief rabbi did. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, the decision of a Rabbanut beis din is appealable, meaning to say, let's say somebody goes before a beis din in Be'er Sheva, and there's a psak. It is appealable to the beis din HaGadol in Yerushalayim. There is like a supreme beis din. And this, you have to understand, is absolutely an innovation, because in classical halacha, you could not take a decision of a beis din to the Sanhedrin. And Rav Kook introduced this in the 1920s, the notion of a higher, remember Rabbi Yashiv, of course, was on the higher beis din. Rabbi Yashiv was the, which you might call the chief dayan of the Rabbanut's beis din of appeal. And in the 1920s, there was a big discussion. There were many posts who said, what do you mean appeal? According to the din of the Gemara, there is no such thing as an appeal of a decision of a beis din. But Rav Kook had many makoros, and Rav Kook basically said that even though the Torah does not create such an institution, kihilos are allowed to create it. That will create better shalom, and therefore he had different makoros that in some societies, particularly Sparta kihilos, there was a practice of appellate judges, and that is the basis of the Rabbanut's function. But as they say to this very day, that's a little controversial. But be it as it may, let's just focus on the Torah structure. The lower beis din are three dayanim. Then there is a higher Sanhedrin that is regional, that is 23 dayanim. That's a pretty big court, 23 judges. And the 23 judges is not an appeal court. You don't appeal from the lower to the higher, but the 23 judges handle capital punishment cases. Any case where somebody might be executed, such as desecration of Shabbos, avodah zarah, murder, has to go not to a beis din of three. A beis din of three can be mechayev you money. A beis din of three can give you malchus, lashes. A beis din of three might obligate you to bring a korban if it was that type of sin. But if the issue is whether or not you're going to be killed, or even sent to the Ir Miklat if you killed Bishogeg, the jurisdiction of that case is given to a beis din of 23. Now, there isn't just one beis din of 23. We don't have numbers exactly, but it was regional, meaning every region of Eretz Yisrael had a beis din of 23, and their jurisdiction was for capital punishment crimes. How often did they kill somebody? Well, as you know, the Mishnah says in Matos that a Sanhedrin that killed somebody even once every 7 years was considered to be a bloody Sanhedrin, because they always found a loophole. They would cross-investigate, they would cross-examine witnesses for any discrepancy. What color socks was the murderer wearing? And if one said navy blue and one said black, all right, we're throwing out the testimony. Rabbi Akiva actually said, Akiva lived after the Sanhedrin was abolished, but he said, if I would be in the Sanhedrin, nobody would ever get killed. Rabbi Akiva would say, if it came to murder, maybe there was a hole in his heart already. Well, what if we checked him and there's no hole in his heart? Well, maybe the knife went into a hole that was already in the heart, meaning there was no way you could get out of it. So people were not killed that often, but nevertheless, this is the function of the 23 judges. Without being modest, the Mishnah gives you a big description of how these different executions would take place. Let me just mention two peculiarities of the system, of the 23-judge system. Number one, you can be convicted only by a majority of two and not by a majority of one. So let's say, of course, there's no such thing as majority of two in number 23, but let's work it this way. If you have 23 judges, and there are 12 judges who want to convict you, and 11 judges who exonerate you, you go free, because you only have a majority of one for conviction, and the majority of one for conviction is not enough. So it can't be 12-11. It has to be at least a majority of two, which by the way, is impossible, because the next number, if you don't have 12-11, your next number is 13-10. So you jump from a majority of one to a majority of three. So practically, you cannot be convicted and given the death penalty unless there are 13 votes for your conviction, because a majority of one is insufficient. Now, that is not true in monetary matters. In monetary matters, of two to one. In other words, one extra vote is enough to be mechayev you, but not for capital crimes. That's rule number one. But rule number two is even more odd. What if you're so bad that all the 23 judges think you did it? 23-0. Strangely enough, Mishnah says when there's unanimous vote for conviction, the guy goes free. So if it's 22-1, he gets executed. 23-0, he goes free. Hard to understand. 23-0, it's so clear he did it. He's so clear he deserves to die that every single judge thinks he's chayav misa. He goes free. By the way, this creates a real moral dilemma if you're judge number 23. Let's imagine we're doing our voting. Think about how you're supposed to do this. Okay. And you are convinced this man deserves to die. But you're the last guy to vote. So they're going down the roster, guilty, 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 it's 22. And guilty. Now it's your turn, and you think he's guilty. But do you see the dilemma here? If I say guilty, he walks. If I say innocent, he gets executed. So, what should I say? Should I say innocent and lie, but then he'll be executed, which is what I believe should happen? Or should I be truthful and say guilty, in which case he walks? Now, by the way, when I say he walks, you understand, because there's a God in the world, nobody ever walks. And I mean, he didn't say, we don't punish him, but if he's in fact guilty, Hashem will. I mean, in a way, that's a great comfort, meaning, obviously, there's always going to be some potential for miscarriage of justice, but because there's Hashem, so, you know, it's going to work out. So the Gemara in Shavuot says, Befeirush, on the pasuk, Midvar Sheker Tircha, that you're not allowed to lie, even if by telling the truth, what's going to happen is exactly the opposite of what you think should happen, you are still mechuyev to tell the truth. But what is the logic of it? Is there a logic? Maybe there's not. Maybe there is a custom. What's the logic? Unanimous, the guy goes free. So again, the Gemara says that there is an obligation in a capital crime to find some mitigating circumstance. We are mechuyev to look for some basis. Everybody has in life, and this is a great, great metaphor for us as well. You know, we're approaching Rosh Hashanah, we're in the month of Elul. We're approaching the days of judgment, the days of awe. And, you know, most of us, we have things we're not so proud of, things that we're a little ashamed of. But we're hoping that Hashem in His mercy will see, you know, our good points, our strong points. And the MS is, as strange as this is, everybody has some argument in their favor. If the court cannot see any possible basis for leniency, we have to assume that the process is tainted and distorted. But there has to be some sechus that somebody sees. Now again, you're going to ask me, well, aren't there obvious cases where there just isn't a sechus? I mean, supposed to, if Hitler would be on trial, you know, so we're supposed to come up with, well, he was good to his calf. I mean, what are you supposed to do? It's a good question. And the truth of the matter is that there are times when the Sanhedrin has reshus to depart from those rules in order to protect society. That's Horash Shah, for example. They could dispense with warnings. They could dispense with the cross-examination. There is a whole temporary way that they could dispense with this when you have unusual situations. But this is the normal. Okay, so I'm just describing the court system. Right? So the lowest court system are three judges for monetary matters and lashes. Then we have the system of capital punishment, 23 judges. And then we have only one court at the very, very top of the pyramid, and at the very top, and that is the called the Sanhedrin, or in the Mishnah it is called Beis Din HaGadol, the highest Beis Din. And that is 71 elders, and that is an unbroken, when it existed, it was an unbroken line of succession from Moshe Rabbeinu himself. Moshe Rabbeinu himself put his hands, gave smicha. The word smicha means to put your hands. Today we use that for rabbinic ordination, even though nobody, there are two things that get smicha. One is, when a judge was appointed to the Sanhedrin, there was the laying of the hands. And the other is when you bring an animal as a korban, you have to put your hands on the animal. So some suggest that if rabbinic ordination is done today with smicha, it's closer to putting it on the cow than it is to. Okay, that's our smicha today. But be it as it may, unbroken. Moshe Rabbeinu put his hands on those 70. He was the 71st, but 70. And every member of every Sanhedrin from that day onward had to be appointed by a laying of the hands of an existing member of the Sanhedrin. So it was an unbroken body that went for hundreds and hundreds of years. And even after the temple was destroyed, the Sanhedrin continued. Even after the Churban of the first Beis HaMikdash and the Churban of the second Beis HaMikdash, the Sanhedrin was probably abolished. It's a bit shrouded in mystery. But the last Sanhedrin was abolished in around the 300s. This is like 200 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And from that point on, we don't have a Sanhedrin. And but that also means we can't make a Sanhedrin. In other words, if I'd ask you the question, well, why can't we just make a Sanhedrin? Pick the greatest, how are you going to do that? It's going to be a question. But we'll pick the greatest rabbis of the generation and make them a Sanhedrin. The answer is no. You see, a Sanhedrin can only exist with samicha, the unbroken laying of the hands. And once that chain has been broken, we have no way of recreating it. Without samicha, we cannot have a Sanhedrin.
Won't this several efforts, though, to reestablish the
Yes, yes. In fact,
still
and in fact, in fact, there's an effort even today to reestablish Sanhedrin. Yes. In fact, there's even a website. Apparently, they don't hold of the internet bans of others, what they did. But here's the thing. Okay. The classical answer is we can't have a Sanhedrin because of the breakup, the discontinuity of smicha. Now, before I get to your question, let's ask the question, so how are we ever going to get it back? What's going to happen when Mashiach comes? We still don't have the unbroken chain. Answer, Eliyahu HaNavi never died. Eliyahu HaNavi was a member of the Sanhedrin. Eliyahu HaNavi has smicha. Eliyahu HaNavi will be able to ordain new judges to be able to take over. Okay. Now, you are 100% correct in noting that there were historically several attempts to reestablish a Sanhedrin, and the most notable attempt was the Rebbe of Rav Yosef Cairo, Rav Yaakov Beirav, in the city of Tzfat in the 1500s, and he based his contention on a passage in the Rambam, where the Rambam suggests that smicha can be spontaneously generated. By that he means, if all of the sages of Israel decide they want to recreate it, so the Rambam was interpreted as saying they could be creative. So he tried to gather the sages to come to an agreement, and he actually gave ordination to four disciples. Yosef Tari was one of them, the Mabit, these are great Gedolim of Tzfat. But unfortunately, it did have opposition, so it was very controversial. There were those who strongly disagreed with his interpretation of the Rambam. So as a result, it became dormant for hundreds and hundreds of years. Meaning it was done in the 1500s, then it was dead. And in recent years, there are people that are trying to do it. Rabbi Steinzel is involved in something called the Sanhedrin. But that's mainly not accepted by too many people because of this answer. Now, don't confuse this with things that are fake Sanhedrins, clearly. And that is, Napoleon tried to create a council of Jewish rabbis to advise him on Jewish affairs, and he gave it the name, the Great Sanhedrin. Although there were some great rabbis on that body, but that was not a Sanhedrin, any halachic says at all, but he called it by the name of Sanhedrin. That was really his name. That was not the name the rabbis gave it. But you are correct. This issue about can we establish a great Sanhedrin is a matter of controversy, but I would just tell you the primary halachic consensus is we cannot, not because, now again, it's important to realize this, it's not because we don't have the temple. The Beis HaMikdash has nothing to do with the Sanhedrin. The thing that stops you from having a Sanhedrin is that we don't have the unbroken smicha. That's the critical issue. And whether you can get it back depends how you interpret a passage in the Rambam. Yeah.
And we don't know why the chain was broken?
Well, oh yeah, we do know why the chain was broken. I mean, the Romans didn't want this to continue. They didn't want the office of the Sanhedrin to continue, and they actually killed the last people that had smicha. So the break was fairly dramatic and fairly clear. They just killed the last people that had it. And in fact, that is why we have a fixed calendar, because when you had a Sanhedrin, they would sanctify the new moon based on witnesses. Now, towards the end of the Sanhedrin, the last Nasiim saw the handwriting on the wall, and they saw that the Romans were not going to allow this, so they kind of worked together the whole calendar to calculate the Rosh Chodesh and begins. By the way, during the Second Temple period, let me just mention this, the Nasi, the word Nasi is the head of the Sanhedrin, Nasi. The Nasi was a hereditary office that was given to the descendants of Hillel. This is during the Second Temple. Now, as far as the Torah is concerned, being a Nasi is not hereditary. They would just pick the greatest judge to be the head of the Sanhedrin. And, you know, it was not a father-son thing. But in honor of Hillel, so to speak, in honor of Hillel, from his time onwards, all the Nasiim, and this is all the way till the abolition of the last Nasi, were direct descendants of Hillel. So, for example, Rabban Gamliel was a grandson of Hillel. And he had a son, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. And he had a son, Rabban Gamliel II, who had a son, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel II. And then they had a son, Yehuda HaNasi, the author of the Mishnah. All of them were descendants of Hillel. What's strange is that the name Shimon Gamliel Yehuda keeps on repeating. No, the name that doesn't repeat is Hillel. The name Hillel doesn't repeat. It's interesting. So my speculation, just a speculation, is that because of Hillel's greatness, just like you retire the number in athletics and baseball, you know, we retire the number, they kind of retired the name, that they would not use the name again. Later, actually, it was used, but at least for many generations, in deference to the greatness of Hillel, they did not want to use the name. And you'll notice, by the way, that Hillel is not called Rabbi Hillel. He's just called Hillel. You will notice, though, when I mentioned the other Nasiim, I mentioned Rabban. Now, again, let me just mention three terms. You may know this, but you may not know this. It might be interesting. Some rabbis are called Rabban, our teacher. Some rabbis are called Rabbi, like Rabbi Akiva. And some rabbis are called Rabbi Yochanan, but let's say Rav Huna. Right, so we have Rabban, Rabbi, Rav. These are three different titles. You have to understand this. Rabban is only the person who is the head of the Sanhedrin. Only a Nasi is given the exceptional title Rabban. So So when you see Rabban Gamliel, that tells you right off the bat, very few people have that. He is a Nasi, he is the head of the Sanhedrin. Rabbi, like Rabbi Akiva, is anyone that has unbroken ordination and is qualified to sit on the Sanhedrin. Now maybe he wasn't, not every, in other words, there were more people that had ordination that were than were on the Sanhedrin, but he was qualified to be on the Sanhedrin. Now, smicha, ordination, is only given in the land of Israel. Ordination was not given in Chutz La'aretz. So the only people that are called Rabbi are the Tanoim of the Mishnah who lived in Eretz Israel, or the Amoraim after the Mishnah who lived in Eretz Israel. That is why Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, they lived in Eretz Israel, they had smicha. But there were great, great scholars in Babylonia, the Amoraim, but they didn't have smicha, because smicha can only be given in Eretz Israel. So in recognition of their great Torah learning, they were called Rav Huna, but they didn't have smicha. Technically, they were not qualified to be on the Sanhedrin. Now, obviously, if they would have come to Eretz Israel, they would have gotten smicha, but they did not. Okay, so that is Rabban, that is Rabbi, and that is explains why Rav Huna, who lived in the same time as Rav Yochanan, Rav Huna is called Rav Huna, and Rav Yochanan is called Rabbi Yochanan. They lived the same time, but Rabbi Yochanan lived in Eretz Israel and he had smicha. Rav Huna lived in Babel, he did not have smicha, but he was worthy of having smicha. Now, let's mention another thing. So why isn't Hillel? So Hillel should be called Rabban Hillel. He certainly should be Rabbi Hillel. He should even be Rabban Hillel. So the Gemara says an interesting point, that in the early generations of exceptional greatness, your name was greater than any title they gave you. Meaning to say, they didn't have to call him Rabbi Hillel, because Hillel was enough. Gadol, the Gemara says like this, Gadol Meirav Rebbe. Rebbe is a greater title than Rabbi. Gadol me Rebbe Rabban. Rabban is a greater title than Rebbe. Gadol me Rabban Shemo. Greater than the title Rabban is the name. The name. And so the early generations, even Moshe Rabbeinu, I mean, we don't call him Rabbi Moshe, Rabbi Rebbe Moshe. Of course, Moshe didn't have smicha. I mean, nobody put their hands on Moshe, you know, other than the Ribbono Shel Olam, the Chavad Uliatzma. Okay? Now, again, I do want to emphasize one thing, because we're so used to the American system or the Canadian system or any other system in which the Supreme Courts, you know, rules on what lower courts do. That's called appeals. Please be sure you understand the Sanhedrin of 70 did not sit in reviewing what other courts did. Other courts did what they did, that was final. It was not an appellate court. It did not review or reverse decisions of other basins. If I wasn't happy with what I got in my basement, I could not go to the Sanhedrin and say, I want the 70 judges to look at this. Okay, it's very important to understand that. So what did they do? So really, they were a combination of a Congress and a court at the same time. Meaning, they made takanos and gezeros, right? In other words, they passed laws. For example, they enacted that you light Hanukkah candles. They enacted that you read the Megillah on Purim. Okay? In other words, they made takanos, various enactments, and gezeros, and prohibitions. They date from the Sanhedrin. We don't always have exact dates. I can't tell you what century were these different gezeros made, but that's what they did. They were in charge of the calendar, Kiddush HaChodesh. They were the final interpreters of the oral law of the Torah Shabbat, meaning they would postulate if electricity is mutter on Shabbos or not. Right? All the shilas now that we have, now we have machloksim, but when there was a Sanhedrin, they would decide by majority vote, and that would be the halacha. Right? They were the final interpreters of the Torah Shabbat. And very rarely there were certain cases that they did. Meaning, if a whole tribe was being convicted of something, right, so they would sit as the court over a whole tribe, things like that. Dear Hani Dachas, we read last week the very unfortunate situation. Like, you remember that? Where a whole city, or most of the city, goes astray and worships idols. And the Torah says the city is wiped out, and everything in the city is destroyed, and it'll never be rebuilt again. Well, who would decide that? I mean, you couldn't just take any base of three people. You know, I don't like Tel Aviv. Let's just, you know, get a base of three people and get rid of Tel Aviv. I mean, this was a national decision, getting rid of a city. So that had to go straight to the Sanhedrin. Okay, things like major national types of issues, a whole tribe, a whole city, and the like. But the main function of the Sanhedrin was takonos, gezeros, and the interpretation of the oral law of the Torah, Shabbat. Now, everyone knows the difference between the takonos and gezeros. These are two types of rabbinic activity. The takonos are positive mitzvahs, like reading the Megillah, lighting Hanukkah. Gezeros are what we call the negatives. That's don't handle muktzah on Shabbos. The Torah doesn't have it. Under Torah law, there's no such thing as muktzah. As long as I don't do 39 categories of work, I can handle money, I could move my computer. But the rabbis, when I say the rabbis, this is an important point. We say the rabbis prohibit. Well, who are the rabbis? Well, some people think, oh, we get together in Or Sameach every Thursday night, we have a meeting. What are we going to prohibit this week? We're not the rabbis. The rabbis is very, very specific. It's not the Tanoim generally, and it's not the Amoraim. The rabbis prohibit is referring to the Sanhedrin at various points. They are the ones who make gezeros and takonos. Now, as I say, we don't have a detailed record of which Sanhedrin did which thing, and I can't even tell you, in the year 200, could I name all the members of the Sanhedrin? We obviously know some people, many of them are in the Mishnah and the Gemara, but many of them are not. They are anonymous members of the Sanhedrin, who must have been very, very great, but their names are not preserved. So when we say the rabbis, now I'll give you an example. A modern gadol today, let's take it, pick the greatest gadol you want, pick Rabbi Yossi, pick Rabbi Yosef. Any gadol. They interpret the Torah, they interpret halakha, but they can't make a new gezeirah or a new takanah. They can't say, we're making a gezeirah, can't do this. They don't have the authority to do that. They could suggest it. They could say it's a good idea, etc. But there's no koach. The koach to make gezeros and takanos is not just based on your being a gadol in Torah. It means you are a member of a body that is called the Sanhedrin. So that is why you'll find in Poskim that we don't have the right to make new gezeros. I'll give you an example of this. There's an issue, and again, this is not halakha l'maaseh because we need a bigger discussion, and I have to stop. Are you allowed to ride a bicycle on Shabbos when there's an Erev? So the strong custom is you should not. But the truth of the matter is, it's not really halakhically forbidden. It's implies not to, because it might break down and you might fix it. You might ride more than 2,000 amos from the city. But we can't really say it's absolutely forbidden, because it doesn't say in the Gemara that you're not allowed to ride a bicycle. Of course, there weren't any bicycles. And without a Sanhedrin, we can't just make new gezeiros. See what I'm saying? So we can say it's a good idea not to, because there'll be problems. But to say something is mamish, mamish usher, you have to link it to either interpreting the Torah or a gezeira or a takana. We can't just make a new gezeira. Okay? So even, this may be a little confusing to you, because if you walk and if you read wall posters, you seem to see new gezeiras all the time. that's an issue. It's complicated. I mean, they use the language of gezeira, but they're really just telling you that spiritually this is not a good thing. It doesn't have the status of a gezeira or a takana. Be a gezeira or a takana, it must come from the Sanhedrin. Now, the one example that may contradict this, and this is a good question, I'm going to leave you with this question, is we do have one outstanding example of something that is clearly a gezeira, that is not only after the Sanhedrin, But it's way after the Gemara itself, even after the Gemara, which is later than the Talmud. And, you know this one, that is in the 11th century, in the 1000s, there was a great, great rabbi in Germany, Rabbeinu Gershow, who was the rabbi, the Rebbe of Rashi's Rebbe, he was before Rashi, and Rabbeinu Gershom and his Beis Din made a number of gezeros that are still in effect today. Among these gezeros are the prohibition against a man marrying two wives, number one, which the Torah allows, and even Chazal allowed. Number two, the prohibition of divorcing a woman against her consent, which the Torah and Chazal allowed. You remember Sefer Gittin? Every Mishnah in Gittin says you can divorce a woman against her will. Rabbeinu Gershom says you can't. And the third, which is interesting, is a prohibition against reading other people's mail. Interesting how you'd update that to email and the like. Now, the question is this. Rabbeinu Gershom was not a member of the Sanhedrin. He certainly was more than 500 years after the abolition of smicha. So what gave him the authority to promulgate gezeiros that are binding on the Jewish people? So the commentaries actually said that since Rabbeinu Gershom's laws only applied to Ashkenazim, they didn't apply to Sephardim. So local rabbinical, what they did, can make gezeiros for their communities. They can't make one for the whole Jewish people. So it's interesting. So it's not just Sephardim didn't accept Rabbeinu Gershom. Halachically, he wouldn't have been able to make a takana that would have applied to everybody, because that's Sanhedrin. So you see the difference. So the difference is that, going back to my Yor Samech analogy, we can get together Thursday night and make all sorts of rules that you're not allowed to do here. We can make gezeiros on the local population, but we can't make a gezeira on others. So we have you in our clutches. that's the idea. So in order to make a gezeira on Am Yisrael, we need a Sanhedrin. Without a Sanhedrin, the greatest Gadol Hador does not have the authority. Okay? So that's kind of the system of that was the role of the great Sanhedrin. And in fact, the Torah even says that if you're a member of the Sanhedrin, you're a member, and they decided the halacha a certain way, and you refuse to accept their ruling, you are executed. You are called a Zakei Mamre, a rebellious elder. Now that's not going to be true today. If I disagree, let's say I disagree with the Pesach of a Gadol. Now, of course I'm wrong, but if I understood the halacha a certain way, I'm not Chayav Misa because I disagree with the Gadol. It would be stupid to do that. And the chances that I got it right and he got it wrong are like zero to a trillion, whatever it would be. But Zakei Mamre only applies when there's a Sanhedrin. Then the punishments are not sure. By the way, interestingly enough, just to give you an idea, the Torah is a very interesting filler. According to the Gemara Sanhedrin, the Zakei Mamre can continue to teach his view as long as he doesn't tell people to follow his view. It's very interesting. Meaning, let's say the Sanhedrin paskened a certain way, and I think they're wrong. I am allowed in my shir to say, they paskened this way, I think they're wrong, I think they misunderstood the Shaila, I think I have better proofs. As long as I don't tell people, follow me, I'm not guilty. Which means, it's very interesting, the Torah encourages freedom of thought and discussion and debate and machlokas, even against the Sanhedrin, as long as it doesn't turn into deviant action. It's a very important shul. You are permitted to keep your teaching, but lemaisa, you must follow the laws of the Pesach of the Sanhedrin. Now maybe. Now the Mishnah Medrash says that a later Sanhedrin, see that. What is the point of my teaching my view if it was rejected? Because by keeping my view out there, so Talmidim know it, if a later Sanhedrin considers it, they could revoke the decision of the earlier Sanhedrin. Okay, so that's the value of a dissent. The value of a dissenting view, even if the halacha we don't pass in that way, is it will give a later Sanhedrin fuel to be able to go back and revisit the halacha. Okay, all right, we'll stop here. Have a real good Sabbath.